From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
Today, it's about lifting up the family of George Floyd. Say his name.
George Floyd.
Say his name.
George Floyd.
It's about lifting up the name of George Floyd.
As historic protests against police brutality continue across the country, we'll go to Houston, Texas, the longtime home of George Floyd, who was killed by Minneapolis police last week. 60,000 people took to the streets Tuesday to honor his memory. We'll speak to two of his friends about his community and religious work mentoring young men in Houston and hear George Floyd in his own words.
I'm gonna speak to y'all real quick. I just want to say, man, that I got my shortcomings and my flaws. I ain't better than nobody else. But, man, the shootings is going on, man. I don't care what hood you from, man. Where you at, man? I love you and God love you, man. Put them guns down, man. That ain't what it is.
Then, as President Trump threatens to designate anti-fascists as terrorists, an internal FBI document reveals the agency found no intelligence indicating Antifa was involved in the unrest over the weekend in Washington, D.C. And we'll look at the 2011 police killing of Kenneth Chamberlain.
My father accidentally triggered his life alert pendant one morning. The police, White Plains police, responded to the home, supposedly to do a medical check to see if he was okay. He told them he was fine, yet they insisted that he open the door. When my father said that he knows his rights and he doesn't have to open the door, they began to bang on the door for over an hour, ultimately breaking the door down and shooting him and killing him.
An appellate court ruled this week a federal judge was wrong to dismiss parts of the lawsuit against the White Plains police. We'll speak with Kenneth Chamberlain's son and the family lawyer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of thousands of people marched and protested in cities across the United States Tuesday, defying citywide curfews, braving police and military repression, shrugging off fears over the spread of the coronavirus in order to protest the police killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. In Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz said Tuesday, the state's Department of Human Rights has opened a civil rights investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department.
The investigation will review MPD's policies, procedures, and practices over the last 10 years to determine if the department has utilized systemic discriminatory practices towards people of color.
Legal observers believe Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison is preparing to charge the three other officers involved in the killing of George Floyd, including two who held Floyd to the pavement while Officer Derek Chauvin pressed his knee into Floyd's neck while he repeatedly gasped, "I can't breathe," before falling still. On Tuesday, Minneapolis police, the Minneapolis Public School District said it was terminating its contract with the city's police department to provide school resource officers. Meanwhile, Minnesota's AFL-CIO Coalition of Labor Unions has joined calls demanding Minneapolis Police Union President Bob Kroll resign after he called George Floyd a violent criminal, described protesters as terrorists, and called on police to expand their use of force. In April, Kroll told a radio podcaster he wasn't bothered by shootings he's been involved in.
I've been involved in three shootings myself, and not one of them has bothered me. You know, maybe I'm different.
Bob Kroll was welcomed to the stage last October by President Trump at a Trump 2020 campaign rally in Minneapolis. In Houston, Texas, 16 members of George Floyd's family joined a crowd of 60,000 protesters who marched to City Hall to remember Floyd, who spent most of his life in Houston. After headlines, we'll go to Houston to speak with two of his friends. A warning to our TV audience, the next story contains disturbing graphic footage. Arrest warrants have been issued for six Atlanta police officers after they tased two black college students, dragging them from their car for allegedly violating the city's curfew Saturday night. One officer was filmed smashing the driver window of the car. Another slashed the car's tires. Two of the officers have already been fired. The victims were 20-year-old Spelman College student Tania Pilgrim and 22-year-old Morehouse College student Messiah Young, who suffered a fractured wrist and needed 24 stitches. He spoke on Tuesday.
I feel a little safer now that these monsters are off of the street and no longer able to terrorize anyone else.
There is an arrest warrant for six Atlanta police officers in this case. In Washington, D.C., 700 soldiers with the U.S. Army's 82nd Airborne armed with fixed bayonets have been deployed to enforce District 7 p.m. curfew. The Army says another 1,400 soldiers are ready to be mobilized to the nation's capital. President Trump reportedly ordered the show of military force as part of Operation Themis, the code name for his domestic military operation against protesters. The name refers to an ancient Greek goddess of law and order. Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports U.S. Attorney General William Barr personally ordered police to beat and tear gas peaceful protesters gathered near the White House Monday in order to clear the path for President Trump to walk to the nearby St. John's Episcopal Church, where Trump posed for photos holding a Bible above his head. Among the hundreds of people tear-gassed was a former assistant rector of St. John's. President Trump visited St. John Paul II National Shrine Tuesday, sparking a new round of criticism from religious leaders. Washington, D.C. Archbishop Wilton Gregory said Trump's visit at this time was, quote, baffling and reprehensible. He is the first African-American Archbishop of Washington, D.C. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has ordered his embassy in Washington to investigate an assault on an Australian camera crew at Monday's peaceful protest outside the White House. Seven Network reporter Amelia Brace was clubbed, tear-gassed, and shot with rubber-coated bullets, while her camera operator, Tim Myers, was hit with a riot shield and punched in the face in a live broadcast that aired across Australia.
We've also seen tear gas being used. Here we go, they're moving through again. This is exactly what it looks like. Exactly what it looks like. We're just staying safely.
Oh, whoa.
The Committee to Protect Journalists has documented at least 125 press freedom violations across the United States through Monday, and new reports of police attacks on reporters continue to emerge. Here in New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio has ordered nightly curfews from 8 p.m. to 5 a.m. through Sunday. On Tuesday, Governor Andrew Cuomo threatened to call out the National Guard, saying the New York Police Department had failed to protect people and property overnight Monday when some people set fires and smashed their way into retail stores. Mayor Bill de Blasio rejected the call at a Tuesday news conference.
Someone needs a history lesson. When outside armed forces go into communities, no good comes of it. We have seen this for decades, go back to the 50s, 60s with the civil rights movement on through all the way up to today.
The New York Police Department says it arrested 200 curfew violators overnight compared to about 700 the night before. In Oregon, an estimated 10,000 people filled Burnside Bridge in Portland Tuesday, laying face down on the pavement for 9 minutes, the length of time George Floyd was pinned beneath three Minneapolis police officers who killed him on May 25th. Later Tuesday, police unleashed volleys of tear gas, flash grenades and pepper spray at protesters who were marching on the downtown jail and police precinct. In Los Angeles, where nearly 3,000 protesters have been arrested arrested since Friday. UCLA issued a statement Tuesday saying it would no longer allow police to use its college baseball stadium as a field jail. The Jackie Robinson Stadium is named after Major League Baseball's first African-American player. Other protesters have been processed in L.A. County's jail system, which on Sunday reported its first death from coronavirus, a 47-year-old prisoner whose name has not been released. Nearly 300 employees and 2,000 prisoners have tested positive for coronavirus in L.A. jails since the pandemic began. Puerto Rico. Protesters marched outside the mansion of Governor Wanda Vasquez in Old San Juan Tuesday with chants for justice for George Floyd, denouncing Puerto Rico's own legacy of racism. Protesters ignored the island's coronavirus curfew and stayed on the streets into the night. This is Shariana Ferreira Nunez, a member of Puerto Rico's feminist collective Under Construction.
We recognize that we must dismantle white supremacy. We must dismantle racialized system. We must eradicate anti-black violence.
In the occupied West Bank, dozens of people protested Tuesday outside the Church of Nativity in the city of Bethlehem, denouncing the police killing of George Floyd and the recent killing of Iyad al-Hayek, a 32-year-old Palestinian special needs student who was shot to death by Israeli forces in occupied East Jerusalem on Saturday. Al-Halak was reportedly chanting Black Lives Matter and Palestinian Lives Matter when Israeli police gunned him down, claiming Al-Halak was armed. This is one of the protesters in Bethlehem yesterday.
We tell the people of the world, the free people and especially the American people, that what happened to them, the killing and racism against George Floyd, also happens in Palestine and to all of Palestine's martyrs. We have today a photo of martyr Iyad al-Hayek, whose experience was not so different from what happened in the U.S. and the U.S. system that killed George.
Thousands of people in cities across France defied coronavirus restrictions against mass gatherings and took to the streets Tuesday for anti-racist protests. In Paris, 20,000 people gathered peacefully demanding an end to police brutality, paying homage to Adama Traoré, a black man who died in police custody in 2016 after he was pinned down by an officer. Late in the day, police fired volleys of tear gas canisters into the crowds to clear the protests. In the latest news on COVID-19, Brazil has reported nearly 1,300 new coronavirus deaths, a new daily high for Brazil. Over 31,000 people have died from virus in Brazil. More than 550,000 have been infected, the world's second highest total behind the United States. Meanwhile, in India, the number of coronavirus cases has topped 200,000, and public health officials fear the peak could still be weeks away. Here in the United States, the U.S. death toll has reached over 106,000. Tyson Foods has revealed nearly 600 workers at a pork processing plant in Storm Lake, Iowa, have tested positive. Most were asymptomatic. Meanwhile, at least 16 graduating cadets at West Point have tested positive after returning to campus ahead of the June 13th commencement, where President Trump is scheduled to speak in person, despite warnings from public health officials about large public gatherings. Once President Trump said he wanted to come and have an in-person graduation, all the cadets were called back from around the country. President Donald Trump has announced he's moving this summer's Republican National Convention from Charlotte, North Carolina. Trump accused North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper of being, quote, still in shelter in place mode after the governor said a full-scale convention could not safely take place during a pandemic. He said he wanted a scaled-down one. Voters cast ballots in eight states and the District of Columbia Tuesday in primary and municipal elections marred by the coronavirus pandemic and police and military crackdowns on street protests, with voting rights activists warning of widespread disenfranchisement. In Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, where polling places remained open even as curfews went into effect, officials said people had permission to be out of their homes if they informed police of their intention to vote. In Baltimore, election officials opened just six in-person voting sites, citing the pandemic. At one polling place, about 100 people, most of them African-American, were still waiting to cast their ballots around 10 p.m. Tuesday night. In Iowa's 4th U.S. congressional district, openly racist Republican Steve King has lost a primary election to challenger Randy Feenstra, who will take on Democratic nominee J.D. Scholten in November's general election. Congressmember King, who's repeatedly praised far-right politicians in Europe, was stripped of his congressional committee assignments last year after he said in an interview with the New York Times, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization. How did that language become offensive, he asked. In Missouri, Ferguson City Council member Ella Jones will become the first African-American mayor in her city's history after winning 54% of the vote on Tuesday. She'll succeed James Knowles III, the former chair of the Missouri Young Republicans, who was Ferguson's mayor throughout the militarized crackdown on protests that followed the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by a white police officer 6 years ago. The officer, Darren Wilson, was never charged. In his first major address since the protests began, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden spoke in Philadelphia Tuesday and criticized President Trump for supporting the use of tear gas and flash grenades to disperse peaceful protesters outside the White House.
But I promise you this. I won't traffic in fear and division. I won't fan the flames of hate. I'll seek to heal the racial wounds that have long plagued our country, not use them for political gain.
Meanwhile, Biden has faced criticism for remarks he made about police training during a meeting with African-American community leaders at Bethel AME Church in Wilmington, Delaware, on Monday.
The idea that instead of standing there and teaching a cop who is an unarmed person of coming at him with a knife or something to shoot him in the leg instead of in the heart is a very different thing.
In India, an estimated 100,000 people, including a number of coronavirus patients, have evacuated low-lying parts of the western states of Gujarat and Maharashtra as a severe cyclone bears down on Mumbai for the first time in documented history. In Central America, at least 15 people were killed after Tropical Storm Amanda sparked severe flooding in El Salvador and Guatemala. The storm traversed from the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico, where it was rechristened Tropical Storm Cristobal. It's the earliest sea-named storm ever recorded. Following Arthur and Bertha, which formed ahead of the official start of the Atlantic hurricane season. Climate scientists warn 2020 is on track to be the hottest year in human history, with atmospheric carbon dioxide levels at 418 parts per million, the highest level in at least 3 million years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and good day to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, there have been protests calling for justice for George Floyd in all 50 states. And on Tuesday, 60,000 people turned out, chanting peace on the left and justice on the right in the city of Houston, Texas, where he grew up. Among them were people from all walks of life, including a contingent of black cowboys and members of George Floyd's high school graduating class, who recalled how George was a star tight end on their football team that went to state championships. This is Mayor Sylvester Turner addressing peaceful protesters in front of City Hall after they marched across downtown.
Today, it's about lifting up the family of George Floyd. Say his name.
George Floyd.
Say his name.
George Floyd.
It's about lifting up the name of George Floyd. It's about supporting 16 members of his family who have taken the time, okay? They have taken the time, walked through the streets just like you did, to be here with you today. And so today, we want to love on them. We want them to know that George did not die in vain. That's important. We want them to know. And I know it made a difference to them when the police chief in Minneapolis recognized that that police officer putting his knee on the neck of George was wrong, that the other three police officers standing there not doing anything, their silence was complicit, was wrong. That's important. And it's important for us in Georgia. this city to stand up and recognize and say his name, George Floyd.
That's Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner speaking Tuesday at a massive rally organized by the Friends of George Floyd, including hip-hop artist Bun B, who also called for more legislation to hold police responsible for violence. The rest of the country knows George Floyd from the cell phone footage captured during his final minutes in Minneapolis just over a week ago, when police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck as he gasped and pleaded, "I can't breathe," and then lay lifeless for minutes as he continued to kneel on his neck, two officers next to him also kneeling on his back. But in Houston's Third Ward, George Floyd is being remembered as Big Floyd and the Gentle Giant, and for how he was a mentor to a generation of young men as he sought to break the cycle of violence in his community. In a minute, we'll be joined by two of his friends who worked on this outreach with him. But first, this is George Floyd in his own words from a post shared on social media.
I want to speak to y'all real quick. I just want to say, man, that I got my shortcomings and my flaws. I ain't better than nobody else. But, man, the shootings is going on, man. I don't care what hood you from, man. Where you at, man? I love you and God love you, man. Put them guns down, man. That ain't what it is, you know. God bless, man, and y'all hold y'all head up, man. You got parents out here sending plates, man, trying to bury their kids, man. Think about it, man. Love y'all.
That's George Floyd. In his own words, speaking in a post he shared on social media. Well, for more, we're going to Houston, where we're joined by two people who worked with George Floyd and his Third Ward community. Patrick Piti Angulo is pastor of the Church Resurrection Houston. He was a friend of and pastor to George Floyd. Also with us, Corey Paul, a Houston hip-hop artist, entrepreneur, who is a friend of George Floyd, ministered with him and Pastor Piti. They both marched Tuesday in Houston with Floyd's family members, community leaders, and tens of thousands of supporters. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! First, we want to share our condolences with you on this horrific loss that you and the whole community in this country is suffering. And I wanted to begin right now with Corey Paul, the Houston hip-hop artist, a friend of George Floyd. Tell us who he was. Tell us how you came to know him, the work you did with him, and then how you learned what happened on Memorial Day. Thanks so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having us. So when I met Big Floyd, I met Big Floyd with Resurrection Houston, with Pastor PT. We were all together. And so we were coming into George's home. We were coming into Third Ward as visitors. We were hopeful to find what we call a person of peace, which is someone who is from Third Ward, who is loved there, who's respected there, so that we can connect with the community and serve from a genuine place. And we were extremely fortunate to meet George. George was already, as you know, as you can see, as you've heard countless times, George was already preaching peace, love, God, unity, advocating against gun violence. He was already doing that before we showed up. And so when we got there, George basically said, "If it's God business, then it's my business." And so that was our introduction. We would shoot visuals and have Bible studies and different things like that in the community. And George came alongside us and, "Whatever you need, however I can serve, you know, let people in the community know we're good. Welcome them. You know, they're here. They're helping us." A lot of things that we could never accomplish by ourselves. I'm from a neighborhood like Third Ward in Houston, and you can't just go into a neighborhood and do what you want to. You desperately need someone like Floyd to usher you into the community, and that's who he was. When I think about the biggest takeaway from my experience with Floyd. It's the unity that he preached. It's the George is a big guy, but then once you're around him and people who know him, you see that all of his respect and admiration is gained through love. It's through nothing else but love. He just happens to be a real big guy. But the unity, the mentoring from guys who were kids in elementary school who are now grown men who have stories of George, taking care of them, putting money in their pocket, just looking out for them and not even a blood relation, So when I was when I found out about what happened to George, I was actually making a video commentating on the Central Park incident where a white lady called the police on a black man saying that he was threatening her life. So I was making that video when my friend Reconcile, who did ministry with us as well, sent me the video about George. So just the weight of that and everything that's been going on, the way I feel is how we see on videos across the world how we're all feeling right now.
And Corey Paul, given the fact that the video of your friend's death has been played over and over again on media around the world, every time you see the video, I'm wondering what you go through and also the impact that it's had, not just in this country, but protests around the world around your friend's death.
Yeah, so I only saw the video partially one time. I didn't. That was the only time that I saw it, just that one time, and I didn't see it again after that. From seeing that on several different levels, you're outraged from a human level, even if George was a stranger, to a personal level. Knowing him, having the opportunity to have met him and worked with him in ministry, and knowing the love and the unity and what he gave and how his life was taken. Also, I served as a Houston firefighter for my city, which made me a first responder and a civil servant. So even the aspect of the video, from him going to having life to being lifeless and the officers continuing to hold him down and stay on his neck, as a first responder, you're in charge of care as well, to the best of your ability, right? And they did the exact opposite, right? So from every aspect of the video, it's no gray area that it was murder. It was a first degree murder. And seeing the reaction around the world from the video is very telling, because I don't think that most people have saw a person go from full of life to the life literally being drained out of them and to the point of death. That video is so graphic that you have to see it, and if you don't see what we see, then you have something inside of you that's foundationally flawed, and hopefully you can figure it out, because it's blatant.
Corey, I wanted to bring Pastor Angulo into this conversation. If you could describe for us the scene yesterday, 60,000 people, at least in Houston, addressed by the mayor, African-American mayor, and as well as many other 16 members of Floyd's family. Describe that scene and how you came to know Floyd, who so many call the gentle giant.
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. The scene was indescribable. I've never seen that many people downtown Houston, even for the time that we won, the Astros won. It didn't compare to the scene that I saw. Just it wasn't just the fact that there were so many people. People were showing so much love. I got there and I had 100 masks ready to give out to people who needed masks. People were coming up to me, giving me masks. And, I'm a big black guy myself, and it's kind of off-putting when people walk up and offer me things. They offered me hand sanitizer, offered me masks, you know, offered me other, substances that, I don't partake of. But, man, it was cool. It was just the gestures were cool. And the love and the unity that was out there and the passion. There were people from 6 to 70 out there, man, just giving. And it made me feel hopeful that people were listening, that the blood of George Floyd was heard by God and was heard by God's people. And I also saw it as a place where, because of the isolation that we've had these past few months, it was also not only a place to protest George, but also a place to convene and to share ideas about what to do next, which was amazing because, you know, it was almost as if people wanted to get it all done here because we weren't sure when we were going to all see each other again. How I met George. I was a student pastor at a church in the Third Ward called Good Hope Baptist Church at the time. And And we were trying to reach the immediate neighborhood and particularly the CUNY Homes housing project. And in trying to reach it, we said, hey, man, let's throw this concert, hip hop concert, rap concert, spoken word concert. And we called it Hope for the Tray. And ironically, man, Corey and Ronnie were opened up that year. And in order to get people from the neighborhood to come, we made some flyers. We went out into the CUNY homes. We passed out flyers. We were skeptical that anybody would come because, man, nobody knew us and we didn't know them. And so we passed out flyers to people in the neighborhood and we say, okay, we'll see what happens the night of. So on the night of the concert, we were scanning the crowd, looking to see people from diverse areas. I mean, we saw people from everywhere, all over the city, all shapes and colors. And we didn't see anybody from the neighborhood we passed flyers out from. And so one of the pastors looks out into the distance, sees this tall guy, head and shoulders above everybody else. And he beckons us and, man, we instantly run, go over there. And it's him and another friend of ours. And it's the first time that we met Big Floyd. Fast forward 2012, we start a church called Resurrection Houston. And we're trying to break into the neighborhood. And Big Floyd was one of the first people to help us to, as a person of peace, open up the neighborhood, man, let people know that we are okay and not to be suspicious of us and that we're doing good work. So those are my first instances of coming in contact with Big Floyd.
And Pastor, I wanted to ask you, when you see, for instance, the images of our president just this week after clearing the protesters in front of the White House with the tear gas and rubber bullets, then walking to a church nearby and holding up a Bible, your thoughts when you've seen those images, given the fact that the president has spent so little time talking about the tragic death of George Floyd and so much time attacking those who are protesting his death?
So I want to start out with this. I'm not a political animal. I'm neither a Democrat or a Republican. I'm actually a theocrat. And so I speak from the outside looking in prophetically, this truth to power. And so the words I'm going to say, I mean, I think they come from a sense of, man, prophetic pain rather than political pain. To see our president, who I pray for, use God's word to endorse state-sponsored violence against citizens of the United States. It brought me pain, and the behavior is wrong. The Bible says that a soft answer turns away wrath. Had he opened it, he would see that and would see that our country needs him to bring down the rhetoric, to bring people together, and hopefully bring this to a peaceful resolution. And so I saw him do the opposite of what my Lord would do, and it pained me to see that. And I believe that that was wrong, and that our president humbly needs to repent from that sin.
I wanted to go to Roxy Washington, the mother of George Floyd's six-year-old daughter, Gianna. She was speaking at a news conference yesterday in Minneapolis.
This is what those officers took from me. At the end of the day, they get to go home and be with their families. Gianna does not have a father. He will never see her grow up, graduate. He will never walk her down the aisle. If it's a problem she's having and she needs her dad, she does not have that anymore. I'm here for my baby. And I'm here for George because I want justice for him. I want justice for him because he was good. No matter what anybody thinks, he was good. And this is the proof that he was a good man.
That's Roxy Washington, the mother of George Floyd's six-year-old daughter, Gianna, who was holding on to her, next to her. We're going to end with Corey Paul. Corey, the importance that the gentle giant that Big Floyd felt being a father, and what you want to see happen right now before the funeral on Tuesday that'll take place in your town in Houston.
Yeah, so I feel like predominantly I can speak on in communities around the nation that are disenfranchised, marginalized, low income, all these communities that politicians and people in general say need change and uplifting and all of these things. George was a leader of that movement. George was the advocate of change. George can't simply be replaced. The neighborhoods that are spoken about oftentimes that need so much radical reformation, you can't just drop in people or information for change. It has to be from a genuine, holistic place. And that's what George represented inside of that community. And I believe there are versions of what George represent all around the nation. But just like a person like George was able to be dehumanized and murdered, and now we have to even fight for justice, shows the lack of reverence and respect for those change makers that maybe don't look like what we think they should look like. But if you get a pulse on the culture and the people, as you can clearly see, these are the difference makers. And so my prayer is that people will understand that it has to be a level of justice and respect and a humanizing factor for us, for people of color, in order for the change that's happening to continue. And George fully embodied through his life, everything that represents. And I hope that we would forever be changed by it.
Corey Paul, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Houston hip-hop artist, entrepreneur, father. He was a friend of George Floyd. And we also want to thank Pastor Patrick Piti Ngwolo. They worked alongside George with the church, Resurrection Houston. When we come back, we're going to look at an FBI report. As President Trump blames Antifa for the violence, well, the FBI didn't find the evidence this weekend. Stay with us.
Sitting on top of the world, drinking the drape off candy paint with a swirl, picking up poppers, scooping them in the shopper, bobbing they come down with my wood grain on chopper, looking real good for my hood is understood, it's a little D and these haters wish they could, knock me off my game, I'm gripping on grain, putting haters in their grave, quit playing stains on the main, I ain't tripping, sir, if I be sipping. Leaning on the switch while I'm pimping, calling up these hoes, riding on Vogue, Lil D acting bad, foreign clothes, got Versace, hoes watch me come down, old Roger, that's in the back in the game, I'm ripping grain, Lil D causing pain, haters going insane, nah, I'm finna look real good, Chris talking about gripping. On this wood, you wanna talk down on some hate, or you wanna look good chopping on some gate. Sitting on top, had to ride flip flop, riding drip drop in the hit the wood boulevard. This Chris Ward, and you know I'm full of Lord. Riding to the wood, headed to the classic. Straight like a casket, man, I brought the tragic. Had to hit you up one time. Let my top down, my bubble eye shine.
Houston DJ Screw's version of Sitting on Top of the World by Big Floyd. That's George Floyd, featuring Chris Ward and AD. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn now to a major development in a case of Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., is an African-American man killed in his own apartment in White Plains, New York, during a police confrontation in 2011, when he accidentally triggered his medical alert pendant. It was, at 5 in the morning, he rolled over on it and it called the Life Aid Company. Well, on Monday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled a federal judge was wrong to dismiss parts of a lawsuit against the police for excessive use of force. The tragic case occurred early on the morning of November 19, 2011, when Kenneth Chamberlain, a 68-year-old former Marine with a heart condition, accidentally pressed the button on his medical alert system while sleeping. It was 5:22 in the morning. Responding to the alert from the company calling police, the White Plains police officers arrived at Chamberlain's apartment in a public housing complex. It was shortly after 5 a.m. By the time the police left the apartment, just after 7 a.m., Kenneth Chamberlain was dead, shot twice in the chest by a police officer inside his own home. Police gained entry to Chamberlain's apartment only after they took his front door off its hinges. Officers first shot him with a taser, then a beanbag shotgun, then with live ammunition. In a moment, we'll be joined by Kenneth Chamberlain's son and by the attorney for the Chamberlain family. But first, we want to turn to the remarkable series of audio and video recordings from the morning of Mr. Chamberlain's death. Before we play these excerpts, we want to warn you they contain disturbing footage. Much of the audio was recorded by Chamberlain's Life Aid medical alert device. The video was recorded from the police taser gun used to shoot him before he was shot dead. After the White Plains police arrived at Kenneth Chamberlain's apartment, Chamberlain told an operator from Life Aid that he was not sick, that he didn't need assistance.
This is your help center for Life Aid. Mr. Chamberlain, do you need help?
This is an emergency. I have the White Plains Police Department banging on my door, and I did not call them, and I am not sick.
Everything's all right, sir?
No, it's not all right. I need help. The White Plains Police Department are banging on my door.
After Kenneth Chamberlain told Life Aid he was okay, but afraid of the police at the door. The Life Aid operator attempted to cancel the call for police assistance. Chamberlain went on to tell the Life Aid operator that the police had drawn their guns and were attempting to break down his door. Again, listen closely.
Officers, this is Life Aid. Are you inside Mr. Chamberlain's home?
They're breaking in my door. They're breaking in my door.
Mr. Chamberlain, I heard you say they're breaking in your door. Are you okay?
My door.
Mr. Chamberlain, are you okay?
I'm fine.
Okay, you pressed your medical button. That's why the officers are there. Can you go to the door and speak to them?
I got to open up the door. They got their guns out. They got their guns out.
Okay, do you have weapon, Mr. Chamberlain?
I don't have weapon. I'm protecting myself.
Okay, they're not there to hurt you. I'm here on the line.
Mr. Chamberlain, we're not here to help hurt you. We're here to do a head help job. I'm okay. I told you I'm okay. That officer was gunning out for me. I'm okay. I'm fine. Leave me alone. I'm fine.
Leave me alone, says Kenneth Chamberlain. One of the officers, Stephen Hart, was accused of hurling a racial slur, the N-word, at Chamberlain during the incident. Listen carefully to this audio released by the White Plains Police Department. You can hear Officer Hart banging on Chamberlain's window. Chamberlain repeatedly says, "Don't do that. I'm okay." The officer responds, "Yes," by using the N-word. Listen closely. A video camera on the police taser gun recorded the next sequence. You can hear Kenneth Chamberlain say the police have stun guns and shotguns. He then predicts the police will kill him. Again, a warning, this contains disturbing footage. Mr. Chamberlain says, "I have a bad heart." While the police were threatening to break down his door, Chamberlain's sister called the police. She was contacted by Life Aid in an attempt to defuse the situation. Soon after, she was assured the police would not shoot her brother. But that is just what happened. Police video shows the moment police broke down his door and shot him with a taser. TV viewers will see a few quick glimpses of Kenneth Chamberlain. The 68-year-old man was wearing boxer shorts and no shirt. He had been woken up. This video was recorded by a camera on the police taser. Listen closely. You can hear the sound of the taser. You can actually see the electricity shooting Kenneth Chamberlain. The video cuts out at this point. Within minutes, Kenneth Chamberlain was shot dead by the police who entered his home. This horrific story is told in the recent feature film, The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain. Well, for more, we're joined by Ken Chamberlain's son, Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., who's been fighting for justice in his father's death since 2011. And we're joined by the family's attorney, Mayo Bartlett. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! This killing that we have covered for years, Kenneth Chamberlain, the significance of what has just taken place. I mean, I share our condolences once again after all of these years, and I'm sure you are reliving this week as we deal with the George Floyd case. But in the midst of all of this, a judge has overturned the decision that throughout the lawsuit you had filed.
Well, thank you, Amy, first for having us on the show, and just listening to that audio, I've kind of had to kind of regain my composure. It's been a while since I've heard all of the audio like that. But we've maintained all along, as the Constitution said, that it is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects from unreasonable search and seizure, and that no warrant shall issue without probable cause. And this is what this fight has been about. You know, what these officers did on November 19, 2011, when my father inadvertently triggered his life aid pendant, and in doing so, the police responded and ended up killing him. Now, with this coming out around the killing of George Floyd and the rallying, the protesting, its significance, I can't really speak to, but what I can say is that what you're seeing happening around the world right now is not just about the killing of George Floyd. It's about the killing of Tamir Rice. It's about the killing of Romali Graham. It's about the killing of Kenneth Chamberlain Sr. and the countless other names that I can't even begin to mention. So we're pleased that these appellate judges vacated the original ruling, and we look forward to our day in court. And hopefully this time around, we will get a fair trial.
And Mayo Bartlett, I wanted to ask you the significance of the Second Circuit Court decision. This has been now a case of 9 years now that has been in one way or another in the courts. And the fact that they claimed that the lower court did not erred in not saying that the police were unlawful in their entry into Mr. Chamberlain's home. Here, a former Marine sleeping peacefully in his own home ends up dead.
Yes, well, thank you very much. You know, it was always our position that there was never a reason for Mr. Chamberlain to have had his home invaded in the first place. And it wasn't necessarily the role of the court to make that determination, but it certainly was the role of the court to allow us to at least argue that to a jury so that a jury could make a reasonable determination one way or the other. We were prevented from doing that. So as a consequence, it's been our position all along that there was no full and fair trial on the merits of this case. And we're thankful now. And it happens to even be something that unites people on the left and the right, because when you look at people who are on the right that you might consider to be extremists, one of the primary things that they talk about is the sanctity of a person's home and your right, whether it's the right to bear arms, but certainly the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure. So this is something where I would believe that most people would be able to agree that when you're at home sleeping and you haven't committed any crime, that you wouldn't expect that the police are going to break your door down and kill you, in particular if they're responding for a medical call where you'd think that they're there to help you.
We're going to go to break, then come back to this discussion. We're talking to Attorney Mayo Bartlett and Kenneth Chamberlain Jr. He is the son of Ken Chamberlain, former Marine who is at home sleeping, turned over on his life alert necklace. He had a heart condition. The life aid people couldn't reach him and called the police. They came in for a wellness check and ended up shooting him dead. We'll be back with them in a minute. The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by composer Joel Thompson, performed by the Sphinx, led by conductor Eugene Rogers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to film. We're speaking with Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., his father shot dead by White Plains police in 2011, and Mayo Bartlett, the attorney for the family. On Monday, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled a federal judge was wrong to dismiss parts of a lawsuit against the police for excessive use of force. A new feature film, The Killing of Kenneth Chamberlain, tells the story of what happened the night White Plains police came to Chamberlain's apartment. This is the trailer.
Mr. Chamberlain, this is Candace Wade with Lifeguard Medical Alerts. This line is being recorded. You just received an activation from your pendant. Do you have an emergency? I'm not getting a response from you. I'm going to dispatch emergency services now.
White Plains Police!
We're here for a welfare check.
Open this door!
Kenneth Chamberlain was played by Frankie Faison in a remarkable film that just recently came out. Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., your thoughts as this country surges with uprisings all over, not only the country, but the world, this decision coming down in the midst of this?
Again, first, let me just say that, of course, my family and I are extremely overjoyed that the original ruling was vacated. I think that, and as far as what's going on in the country, I think that people are now coming together and they're saying that extrajudicial killings and summary executions of unarmed Black men, women, and children is no longer going to be tolerated. I mean, what we have been witnessing for decades are crimes against humanity. So to see such a diverse group of people coming together saying that they're no longer going to tolerate this, this is beautiful. And the fact that they made this ruling, if I can use my platform to help affect positive change, then that's what I'm going to do.
And Mayo Bartlett, I wanted to ask you, the Supreme Court is slated to decide very soon whether it will take up the cases that deal with qualified immunity. Could you talk about what is qualified immunity and how does it affect this particular case?
Qualified immunity is a doctrine which the Supreme Court actually created, which gives police an extraordinary shield for their conduct. And it's a shielding that no other person in the country has. It says that unless we can find basically that no other reasonable officer anywhere could have done what this officer did, that person's going to be found to be exonerated. You're going to say that their conduct is absolved. And it requires a tremendous burden on the part of people trying to bring these cases. The other thing that it does is it deters lots of lawyers from taking these cases because you dedicate a lot of time and a lot of money into these cases, and it may be 4 or 5 years, or in our case, we're here 9 years, almost 10 years later, without having a resolution. And sometimes these qualified immunity decisions don't come until fairly late in the game after you've already invested a lot of time and money, so it's a deterrent for people.
And again, no officer was charged in this case. I mean, there were many officers, including Officer Hart, who shot Kenneth Chamberlain dead, undisputed.
Absolutely. And one of the things we've asked for from the beginning is for an independent investigator. And when you look at these cases, there should also, in my estimation, be a change in the grand jury system. The grand jury should not be an arm of the prosecutor. It should be independent, equally accessible from the defense as well as civil sides, and also for the prosecutor. Should not be on the third or fourth floor of a DA's office. And you should be able to see what happened in the grand jury. It shouldn't be secret. There's no need for it to be secret. If there is a need, then you can make an application to a court for a protective order. But we believe that needs to change, as well as the disciplinary procedures against police, where there's been a finding of misconduct. That also should be public and readily available. You should not have to go to the police department to find out what misconduct your officers may
have
engaged
in. There's no time limit on murder. Why can't the officer be charged now?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been no jeopardy that's attached. The officer certainly could be charged now.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you, though, Mayo Bartlett, attorney for the family of Kenneth Chamberlain, and especially Ken Chamberlain Jr. himself. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.